Friends, we close out the book of Job this week. A wonderful book. I really have been prayerful for us that we've been reading through it and wrestling with it. It's a tough book, and it gets no easier at the end. And so at the beginning, we begin with this prologue, and Job also has an epilogue. In the prologue, we meet a man named Job who is unlike any other. He's presented to us as one who is blameless and upright, who fears the Lord and shuns evil. The accuser comes in with the angels to present themselves to the Lord. Job is brought up in conversation. The accuser is asked a question by the Lord. Where have you come from? From roaming to and fro, back and forth in the earth. What is he looking for? He's looking for those that have been unfaithful in the kingdom, that he can bring a case of accusation to the one who sits on the throne. The Lord then asks the accuser, "Have you considered my servant Job?" The Lord offers Job up as one for the accuser to test for faithfulness. The accuser says, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" He raises the challenge of Job's health, his prosperity, as well as the protection, the hedge that's been placed around him. God removes the hedge and says, "But you can't touch his life." And so we find that everything was stripped from Job: his children, his possessions, his land. His hedge, quite literally, has been broken down. It's been made level, right? Job is invited to curse God and die. Job remains faithful. Shall we accept good from the Lord and not trouble? A second time, we're told that the angels come to present themselves to the Lord, and the accuser comes in with them. And a similar conversation ensues. Have you considered, where have you come from? "I've come from roaming the earth looking for those that are unfaithful. Have you considered my servant Job? Does Job fear God for nothing? You didn't allow me to touch his life." Life for life. A man will give up everything so long as he retains his life. Okay, you have access to his body, but you cannot take his life. And this happens. Not only has Job's hedge been taken away, but now his body experiences great pain. Job has been put in the position of one who suffers by virtue of circumstance, but he also suffers by virtue of experience in his body. And again, he's invited to curse God and die. Are you going to continue to hold on to your integrity? And Job again in the prologue says, "Shall we accept good from the Lord and not trouble?" And in this way, he did not sin. He was blameless before the Lord. That is steady throughout the book of Job. Then we read Job chapter 3. And in Job chapter 3, Job curses the day that he was born. He does so in such a way that I think is consistent with all of his dialogue. All of his dialogue that he has with these three friends who show up and sit with him in ashes, which is a posture of despair, as well as a posture of repentance. And he's sitting in the ash of his life that feels like ash, right? And he picks at his scabs with broken pottery. And he curses the day that he's been born. In his dialogue, he's going to argue for his integrity, for his blamelessness, that he's lived blamelessly before the Lord. And that's important, I think, in order to read the text well, is why curse the day that you were born? Is he is saying, if this is what a life integrity wins for you, then it would have been better off if I would have never been born. And so he's making the case to say what was set before him was that a life of integrity would bring God's blessing. And the experience that he's now having is not what one would call blessed. And it creates the theological struggle of the text, right? Have you experienced times in your life where you could say, God, I'm living for you. I love you. I'm seeking to honor you with my life, but my circumstances stink. And even my body is rebelling against me. You say, Lord, this is not the blessed life that I thought it would be. Ever been there? Yes, maybe a day or two. The dialogue in the text with these three friends is they're saying, your experience, Job, makes it quite clear that you are not as blameless as you say you are. Otherwise, God wouldn't treat you like this. And Job, increasingly, as the text progresses, becomes more fierce related to his integrity. He doesn't back down. The more they argue, it's not as though he goes, yeah, you guys are right. I'm really not as good as I think I am. He becomes increasingly fierce, saying, no, I am blameless before the Lord. Even the Lord, I need God to show up because your arguments are not true. I am blameless before the Lord. I must bring my case before the God of heaven. For he knows that I'm blameless. He's convinced of this. And so he becomes increasingly fierce to say, ah, God of heaven, draw near to me. Prove to me that I am sinful. Because as far as I can tell, I'm blameless before you. I'm right in your eyes. And yet, even though he becomes increasingly fierce, which in a lot of ways, friends, is this developing storm inside of Job, this storm of the friends, and then we meet Elihu, and Elihu energizes into the dialogue this need to prepare us for God to come onto the scene, onto the stage. Elihu invites Job to recover his sense of wonder. And in this way, he invites Job to look beyond himself. It's healthy for us to encounter Elihu. When we suffer, friends, our eyes turn inward. That's true. We begin to look at our experience, to evaluate our experience, and we do so all in terms of our self-centeredness. Why is this happening to me? Right? Generally, when other people suffer, we're not asking them, boy, why are they suffering anyways? When we suffer, we When we experience suffering, we are centered upon ourselves. And Elihu speaks brashly, even arrogantly, to Job, saying, "You need to get over yourself," essentially. Might we be so bold to sometimes say that to one another? You really need to get over yourself. I need to hear that more often than I would like to admit. Then God enters the scene. And we think actually that we're prepared for it, right? The Lord speaks. This is chapter 38. "Then the Lord answered Job." Are you there? Is that the way the sentence ends? "Then the Lord answered Job." Finish it for me, somebody who's there. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm." This does not meet our expectation. Job has experienced suffering. We oftentimes compare suffering to the storms in our life, right? That's what we call suffering or troubled times, right? We call those storms. Yes, this is familiar language to you. We are so ready for God to enter the scene, because when God enters the scene, we anticipate that God is going to make all things right. He's going to fix everything. He's going to calm the storm. God enters the scene, and he does so how? Out of the storm. He meets Job, who is in the storm, with a storm. And then he begins to comfort Job. Actually, no. He does not comfort Job. To say, "You know, Job, you've done so beautifully and so wonderfully through all of this. Let me just outline why all of these things had to happen to you." And then he just begins to listen. He doesn't do this. The Job who is experiencing the storms of life meets with God, who comes to him as a storm. And then he says, and he meets him to rebuke him. "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge?" And then he says, verse 3, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer me." Now, time out. Before we get into God addressing Job here, we need to answer the question of whether or not it's okay that God rebukes Job, right, in the midst of his suffering. He's already been faithful, and his dialogue suggests that he has lived indeed a life of integrity. His life is straight before the Lord. It's not crooked. And so it runs true. There's no untruth in Job. And that's never denied in the text. We're never told that his friends prove him wrong, or even that Elihu proves him wrong. What Elihu does is invite him to look beyond himself. Hear what Elihu would say: "Job, it's not about you." There you go. That's the Elihu speeches condensed. "Job, it's not about you." And then God is going to confirm Elihu's speeches, actually. But is it okay that God rebukes Job? And you say, well, the right answer is yes, of course it is. He's God. And you wouldn't be here if you didn't agree with that, right? You've been probably rebuked by the Lord. We call that conviction. So God rebukes Job. But there's actually some other instances in which we see that from Jesus, right? So we have James and Andrew. They are rejected in a town. And as they leave that town, they turn to Jesus and they say, should we act like prophets here? Should we call down fire from heaven? That this place that has rejected you would experience the condemnation of heaven. And Jesus rebukes them. Peter, when pulls Jesus aside, when he predicts his death, and he says, this should never happen to you. Jesus rebukes him, says, you do not have in mind the things of heaven, the things of God, but only the things of man. There are multiple places where we see Jesus rebuke his disciples on their theology. That this is the way the world is supposed to work, and it's not working that way. And Jesus rebukes them and says, essentially, this is not about you. God is up to something that's actually bigger than you. Let's get back into the text where we hear God begin to rebuke Job. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you understand. So his first line of argument is, although I laid the foundation of the earth, you clearly know more than I do, so you teach me what I don't know, how I got it wrong. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know that. Please tell me. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Oh, and by the way, where were its footings set? And who laid its cornerstone? So he's inviting, much like Elihu does here, is to say, Job, it's not about you. Here God comes and he begins to rebuke Job by asking him to teach him on the foundation of creation. Surely, Job, you know how creation came about. Surely, Job, you know how the foundations were set. Surely, Job, you know how the limitations were set. And not only set, but remain established. He's going to go on. He's going to talk about the storehouses of snow. He's going to go on and talk about the rain. He's going to go on and he's going to talk about the pathway of the thunderstorm. He's going to go on and he's going to invite Job to recognize that the God who created and established all things is watching over them, providing that which is needed to not only create creation, but to sustain creation. And so he invites Job to look at and appreciate that not only is there a creation, but it is a creation that is sustainable. It's a creation that continues to go, to move, to use different language. He's created a sustainable creation that works. And then he's going to turn his attention to the animal kingdom. And so if I were to tell you that the first part of God's rebuke is that in the midst of suffering, Job has been centered on himself. Elihu comes and decenters him, and then God comes to him and rebukes him, saying, you've lost your sense of the wonder of my creation. This is a wondrous creation, a creation in which you had nothing to do with, nor is anything that you do maintaining its sustaining character. You have nothing to do with that. Notice, friends, he doesn't come to him and he doesn't come after him about his integrity. His integrity is intact. He comes after him that he's lost his sense of the godness of God. Or to say that differently, the bigness of God. And so he begins to show him the bigness of his creation, right? He says, this creation that you have enjoyed and are now suffering in is a creation that is sustained. It is a creation that has a foundation. It is a creation that has limits that make it sustainable. It is a creation that you do nothing to usher in the dawn. It is a creation that hardly pays attention to you. Notice Job's response. It's just at the wonder of creation. Really, friends, it's the wonder of creation that this is Job's response. Chapter 40. Then Job answered the Lord, I'm unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. Here he's intensifying his language. God, you've shown me the wondrousness of your creation, and I have doubted that you are a God who not only sustains creation, but that you are even sustaining me in the midst of my suffering. That the God who sustains creation can sustain me, even though I am small and nothing. Creation is big and wondrous beyond compare, and God sustains it. Job says, I put my hand over my mouth because I recognize that I have brought a case before the King of creation and said, pay attention to my suffering. And God says, I pay attention to all of creation. Who do you think you are anyway? Job puts his hand over his mouth and says, you're right. If you can sustain the bigness of creation, who am I, smaller than nothing, to bring a case before you and make demands of you? God doesn't stop there. He continues to rebuke him. And I think what we could call the first discourse is the wonder of creation. And Job, just at the wonder of creation, Job covers his mouth and says, I spoke once, but even speaking, that was too much. And then he intensifies it, is to say, I spoke a second time. You can imagine him thinking about all of these dialogues that he's had, right? I kept speaking, and I was speaking inappropriately. The God who sustained creation is sustaining me every step of the way. The second dialogue is a rebuke as well. And it's fascinating that verse 3 of chapter 40, then the Lord spoke to Job again out of the storm. To say it, God has come to him. The storm is brewing toward Job. Brace yourself like a man. I'll question you and you shall answer me. Job just said, I mean, he's trying to get out of this, right? God has now shown up. The God that Job asked to show up and he longs for. And he's like, okay, I'm covering my mouth. God, please, no more. God continues to lay it on. We might use the language, you're really laying it on thick. God is laying it on thick to Job. Brace yourself like a man. I'll question you and you will answer me. Will you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? Can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor and clothe yourself in both honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in dust and ashes. Shroud their faces to the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. Oh man, he is after Job. The second rebuke is for Job to acknowledge the wild kingdom. So first, he's invited to look at the wonder, the wondrous kingdom. And secondly, he's invited to look at the wild kingdom. Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you, which feeds on grass like an ox. What strength he has in his body. What power in the muscles of his belly. His tail sways like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are close-knit. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like rods of iron. He ranks first among the works of God. Yet his maker can approach him with his sword. The hills bring him their produce, and all the wild animals play nearby. Under the lotus plants, he lies hidden among the reeds in the marsh. The lotuses conceal him in their shadow. The poplars by the stream surround him. When the river rages, he is not alarmed. He is secure, though the Jordan should surge against his mouth. Can anyone capture him by the eyes or trap him and pierce his nose? So the first animal that he invites Job to consider is this animal that is described with strength. Strength beyond compare. He's strong. William Brown, I like how he does this. He's a scholar from Columbia Seminary, and he parallels Behemoth in this rebuke that God presents Behemoth as one who is wild and strong, and that God delights in that about this creature, strong. What's fascinating is he then, verse 23, when the river rages, he is not alarmed. He is secure, though the Jordan surge against his mouth. And he asks the question, why is the mouth used there? Why is that language there? And I like what Brown proposes here, is that in God's rebuke of Job related to the wild kingdom, is that in the wondrous kingdom, is that Job, even in the midst of suffering, recognizes if the God of creation sustains creation, he's also sustaining me. Now, in this wild kingdom, we're given this animal, this creature who is strong, that there's a parallel that's being made, that God is rebuking Job to say, you want to reject the way in which I desire to strengthen you. It is in the wild kingdom, this behemoth, that he has strength. The muscles in his torso are without compare. His limbs are like rods of iron. And Brown says, if you go back and you look at Job's language, early on he talks about how he is weak, that he lacks strength, that he wants to be like iron, he wants to be like bronze, he wants to have strength, but he's been made weak. And that as his dialogues continue, you see him getting stronger. His language intensifies. He is being strengthened even in the midst of suffering, so that when God addressed him and say, you would reject the way in which I'm making you strong, so that you can be like those in my wild kingdom that I have not only created, but I sustain. Not only have I sustained you, but I am making you strong. Whoa. And then he goes on and he addresses this creature, Leviathan. Can you pull in Leviathan with a fishhook? Or tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose? or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he keep begging you for mercy? Will he speak with you to you with a gentle word? Do you hear it? Again, language is being that this wild creature would speak with gentle words. Again, Brown makes the parallel between Job and the intensification of his words to that which is true of Leviathan. You don't answer him with gentle words. He's harsh. He's strong. Will he make an agreement with you for you to take him as your slave for life? Can you make a pet of him like a bird or put a leash on him for your girls? Will traders barter for him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his hide with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? If you lay a hand on him, you will remember the struggle and never do it again. Any hope of subduing him is false. The mere sight of him is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse him. Who then is able to stand up against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. I will not fail to speak of his limbs, his strength, and his graceful form. Who can strip off his outer coat? Who would approach him with a bridle? Who dares open the doors of his mouth, ringed about with his fearsome teeth? His back has rows of shields, tightly sealed together, each so close to the next that no air can pass between. They are joined fast to another. They cling together and cannot be parted. His snorting throws out flashes of light. His eyes are like the rays of dawn. Firebrands stream from his mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from his nostrils as from a boiling pot over a fire of reeds. His breath sets coals ablaze and flames dart from his mouth. Strength resides in his neck. Dismay goes before him. The folds of his flesh are tightly joined. They're firm. They're immovable. His chest is as hard as a rock, hard as a lower millstone. When he rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before his thrashing. The sword that reaches him has no effect, nor does the spear or the dart or the javelin. Iron he treats like straw and bronze like rotten wood. Arrows do not make him flee. Sling stones are like chaff to him. A club seems to him but a piece of straw. He laughs at the rattling of the lance. His undersides are jagged potsherds, leaving his trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. He makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron and stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him, he leaves a glistening wake. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all the haughty. He is king over all that are proud. Brown would contend that in God's rebuke of Job, he's inviting him to see the wild kingdom, these creatures that are beyond compare, behemoth strength beyond compare, and Leviathan fearless, fearless. And Brown would contend, and I at this point I agree with him, that God is saying, Job, I've made you like them. I've made you not only the greatest among men, but now I've made you strong. I've made you without compare. I've made you fearless. Listen to Job's response. Chapter 42. I know that you can do all things, that no plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not know, things that are too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen, and I will speak. I will question you and you will answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." We say, why? Why does he despise himself and repent in dust and ashes? Because he had sought to reject what God desired to do. He had sought to reject what God had desired to do in him. The faithfulness of Job was never in question. What actually comes about is that what is in question is God's faithfulness. And so where we land at the end of Job is this rebuke that calls Job to recognize that in all circumstances, particularly in suffering, even in the midst of our faithfulness, we have a God who's even more faithful. So what's at question in the book of Job and what we feel when we suffer is not our faithfulness. What we question is God's faithfulness. And Job repents in dust and ashes because he desired to reject God's faithfulness to do in him what otherwise couldn't be done. Job's character has been transformed. One who referred to himself as weak has now been made strong. One who was described as fearful has now become fearless. And then we have the epilogue, and I want to share a couple of things quickly. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "I'm angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." There again, Job, throughout the dialogue, was right. He held on to his integrity. He said, "I am blameless before the Lord." He was. That's true. "So now take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Friends, a transformation has happened in Job. Because I'm telling you, if the friends treated me like that, I am not praying for them. You say, that's not very Christian. Yeah, hey, you experienced what Job did, right? So here, God says, not go to him and ask him to offer a prayer for you. And notice that the compassion that they were to offer Job, they never did. They never offered Job compassion. They only offered him answers that were insufficient. They never offer him compassion. How do we know that Job is transformed? Job offers them compassion that they didn't offer him. He prays for them as an act of his compassion for them. Guys, I get it. I didn't have any answers either. And you didn't either. You did the best you could with what you knew. Just so happens that what you knew was not sufficient. Guys, I understand. I love you. Thank you for coming. It was unhelpful. Pray for you. And so, as an act of compassion toward the friends, he prays for them and the Lord accepts his answer. Isn't it interesting that suffering has a tendency, when we have suffered, that we become increasingly compassionate toward those who have similar like we have? Paul would pick this up to his letter, in his letter to the Corinthians. He says that God is the God of all comfort and he will comfort you with the same comfort that you have received, that you might then comfort others with the same comfort that you have received from him. So when we suffer, we experience comfort, and then we share that comfort with others. It's fascinating. When we suffer, we become increasingly compassionate to those who suffer similarly. Not to mention that we come out of suffering, at least according to Job, with a strength that we didn't previously have and a fearlessness that we didn't previously know. Then it says, verse 11, I need to finish up here, friends. All his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him before came and ate with him at his house. They comforted and consoled him over all the trouble the Lord had brought upon him, and each one gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters, the same as what he had in the prologue. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Keren Hapuk. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters. And their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. This is striking. Job presents his daughters with an inheritance. This would have been not normative in that culture. And so he grants them an inheritance along with the brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation, and so he died, old and full of years. One last note. Do you remember in the prologue, what did Job do every day? Do you remember? It says that his children would gather together and they would feast together. And Job, fearful that they might in some way disobey or offend God by their action, offers a sacrifice on their behalf. Every day, every day. He's anxious. Ah, God, what if my children do something that doesn't honor you? I don't know what to do with them. Oh, God, please save them. Oh, I don't know. He's anxious every day. You know what's true of the epilogue? Job gives an inheritance to his daughters. He makes no sacrifice day after day after day. Why? Why? That seems like it would be a really kind thing to do as a parent, right? You should care for them to the utmost degree so that, man, if in some way that they are ignorant of, that they would offend God, that I would already have them covered, that I could protect them in such a way. Job has learned that the God who's faithful in the intensity of his suffering will be faithful to his children way more than he could ever be in his daily sacrifice. And so he takes his hands off. That doesn't mean he's not involved. He takes his hands off and he says, God, I trust you with them. They might experience suffering like I have. But I know that you're a faithful God. That you are a God who brings the sufferer through it. And maybe even make them strong because of it. And give them a fearlessness to live for you in a way that they otherwise would not have known. God, I trust you to make them strong in yourself. God, I trust you to make them fearless for you. Oh. Friends, sometimes I wonder if we live in such weakness and fear because we reject God's opportunity, God's invitation to suffer. That doesn't mean that we pursue it, right? Wasn't it as though Job said, hey, you know what? It would be a great idea. Let's go suffer. Yeah, I'm going to make bad decisions so I can suffer. No, no, no. Job lived with integrity. That's true throughout the entire text. Even at the end, in the epilogue, it says, the three friends, you said to Job that which was not true. He doesn't say Job was arrogant. He doesn't say Job was overstated. He said Job spoke what was right. Job lived a life of integrity and he suffered. Friends, we should live a life of integrity that when we suffer, we can trust a God who's faithful in the midst of suffering to do in us what we could never do for ourselves. That he will make us strong and fearless. Not because of something, some inner strength, some inner fearlessness that we have that we can willpower our way toward. No, no, that the God of heaven meets us and is faithful to produce in us what we could not produce in ourselves. A strength and a resolve and a fearlessness for him that we otherwise might never know. So we finish the book of Job and we come away and we say, that gave me no answers. That's true. But it does give us an invitation to really trust that God is faithful. Do we really believe that God is faithful? Friends, that's our invitation today. Let me pray. You are the God of heaven. We call you Father. I'm thankful for that. And that as Father, you loved us to such a degree that while we were still sinners, you sent your Son who lived a perfect life, and who died a perfect death, and who rose in a perfect body, a resurrected body, and who sits at the right hand of the Father, perfectly interceding for those that would receive the perfection of himself. And in receiving the perfection of himself, he gives us the very spirit of himself to make his perfection real in our life. And that you are the Father who faithfully works this out. And in our life and in our humanness, this, if we want to call it this, perfection is the way in which you purify us like pure gold. May it be so. May it be so. May it be so. We trust you today because you are the faithful God. We submit this to you, Father, in the name of your Son, Jesus the Christ, our saving Lord. Amen.